Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we have Andrea Wolf on the invention of nature.
Thank you for coming. Quite a competition with the tanks outside, so we're going to talk about plants today, not war. And I thought I'm going to start with an admission. I am not a practical gardener at all. I have no green thumb whatsoever. In fact, when I moved from Germany to Britain in the mid-1990s, until then I was not interested in gardens at all. And I was rather surprised when I came here how obsessed the British are with gardens. Everybody seemed to think a day digging in the flower beds the greatest entertainment. And British gardeners like to show off, so there are something like 4,000 private gardens open to the public. I think it's the only country where there are TV gardening celebrities. When my first book came out, I got a quote from Kim Wilde, which they put on the book, and my German friends all thought, what's going on? She's an 80s pop star. Why would she give you a quote for a garden book? So in the past 17 years, I've just been watching this obsession. And a few years ago, the Royal Horticultural Society diagnosed a new national affliction, plant bereavement, as if the British don't suffer enough. Apparently, British gardeners go through the same stages of grief when losing a plant as when losing a pet or family member. And the Royal Horticultural Society's Plant Advisory Service is dealing half the time with the trauma caused by damaged plants. Only half the other time, they're kind of dealing with the actual horticultural advice. And then I was asked by The Guardian to write an article about garden crime. So I realized that, you know, even the thieves in this country think it's worth stealing plants. But then I got really, really worried about this obsession when I, for that article, had to interview the director of a company which specializes on plant crime. And this is what he told me. He said, they were currently looking to implement a variation on the latest anti-terrorism technology in an effort to reduce garden crime. So a bit worrisome, I think. So I'm still amazed after 17 years how much time I spent with my English friends talking about the successes and failures of their vegetable plots and their flower beds. My English friends sent me photographs of their flower beds. My German friends think it's rather odd that I write about gardens, because none of my German friends is a passionate gardener, but that might just be a coincidence, but they all prefer to live in big apartments rather than in houses with gardens. So in Germany, I had associated gardens with half-empty flower beds, few pansies here and there, a lot of beautifully cut lawn and miles and miles and miles of perfectly trimmed hedges. Because the Germans seem to take a rather more regimented approach to nature, because this is how a proper German hedge looks like. Like this, or like this, or like this, or like this. This is actually quite adventurous, because you see it's kind of a little bit undulating there. So I took these pictures when I was researching the Brother Gardeners, and I was staying with my best friend there, and I put forward this theory that I think that the English are this kind of nation of obsessive gardeners and the Germans aren't. And she said that it's a bit unfair, that, you know, there are some nice gardens in Germany. So I said, well, let's just go outside and have a look. And these pictures, this is her street. I could have shown you 20 more. So they just all look the same. And so she kind of agreed with me, especially when we came to the very last house in her road, which was this. This is really as English as the German garden gets. But let's go back to the English. So I wanted to try and figure out why the English are such an obsessive gardening nation. And what I found was this really extraordinary story of friendship, obsession, the empire, competition. And it was a story of a garden revolution in the 18th century. And it's the story of a network of men gardeners, botanists, scientists who together created this craze for gardening in the 18th century and who turned Britain really into this nation of amateur gardeners. And it's a story of six men. It's Peter Collinson, who was a Quaker, a London, very wealthy London cloth merchant. John Bartram, who was a American plant hunter and gardener who lived just outside Philadelphia. Philip Miller, there's no portrait of him, so I can't show you one, who was the head gardener of the Chelsea Physic Garden. Then Carl Linnaeus, a rather obsessive botanist and a little bit cantankerous. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about that later. And then there was his pupil, the very charming Daniel Solander, also from Sweden. And then the rather handsome Joseph Banks. He, you know, goes a bit fatter and uglier when he gets older, but I prefer this picture here. So together, they really changed the world of botany and horticulture. And today, our flower beds are populated, kind of brimming with the suburban descendants of the plants that had arrived at that time from South Africa, the Far East, North America. So these are the plants, the kind of offspring of the species that Joseph Banks grew in Kew, that Philip Miller grew in the Chelsea Physic Garden, and that John Bartram sent over from the North American colonies. Even England's rolling parkland, the epitome of the green and pleasant land, is actually made up of these foreign introductions. And without those, we would be deprived of much of the pleasure we see in the garden today, of the kind of dazzling autumn color, of glossy evergreens, and of a lot of summer blossom. And I think that this garden revolution of the 18th century is still very, very much alive in our garden and in this nation's psyche. But let me take you to a cold winter morning in January 1734, when the cloth merchant Peter Collinson is rushing from his office in the city of London down to the Thames. And on his way, he can already see the shipmasts dancing over the rooftops. He can hear the cries of the stevedores as they're unpacking precious goods, which have arrived from all over the world. So these are ships which are coming from China, bringing silk and tea. They're coming and bringing sugar from the West Indies, spices from the East Indies, and corn and tobacco from the North American colonies. But Collinson is not going to pick up any of that. He's picking up the most exciting merchandise he's ever picked up. He's picking up two huge wooden boxes filled with seeds, all of them kind of neatly wrapped up in paper. And when he opens the box, he sees, to his great astonishment, two flourishing cuttings of the kalmia. Now, he had seen the kalmia on this illustration, which is by Mark Catesby, who had gone earlier in the 18th century to the North American colonies, and he kind of came back with these absolutely beautiful botanical drawings. So Collinson had fallen in love with the kalmia and this kind of almost the blossom which opens like little mini umbrellas. And he, for years and years, had asked his business partners in North America to send him some, and no one had ever done it. But so he opens the box, he sees them, and he just can't believe his luck. And these two boxes were sent by John Bartram, who was a farmer, had a farm just outside Philadelphia, and he had been put in contact with Peter Collinson through their mutual friend, Benjamin Franklin. And these two boxes are really the beginning of the most important horticultural friendship in the 18th century. Together, Collinson and Bartram would completely transform the English garden. They set up a subscription system whereby English gardeners would pay 5 guineas for one of those big boxes. And slowly, a rhythm developed where Bartram would go plant hunting in autumn in the North American colonies. And then he would spend the winter sorting the seeds and writing long kind of lists. Then he would ship them over to London. And then Peter Collinson would receive the boxes, divide them up, and distribute them to the English gardeners, never receiving a single penny for this service. But he did get the very best plants from Bartram. And Bartram would, over the years, travel pretty much every single bit of the colonies. And he traveled thousands and thousands of miles along deserted mountain paths. And he spent a lot of time in the in the southern states, and he went to the Appalachian Mountains. Oh, this is Bartram's house as it is today. Very beautiful. So if you're ever in Philadelphia, you should go there. So he went, for example, to the Appalachian Mountains. And this is a photograph of the Shenandoah National Park. And this was pretty much the landscape he was seeing. So here were the trees that the English gardeners were very keen on. And he would find sugar maples here, he would find scarlet oak, flowering dogwood, conifers such as eastern hemlock, and evergreens such as kalmias and rhododendrons. They, when he came back from his travels, he would send the plants, the seeds, to Collinson, and he would write these beautiful letters describing all the landscapes he had seen. So Peter Collinson could follow him step by step from the comfort of his armchair in London. And most of the time he enjoyed it, but Collinson was always a little bit upset that Bartram never encountered any more dangerous beasts other than rattlesnakes. So he writes, for example, from the safety of his country house in Peckham, he asked him, why has no panther sprung out of a thicket, or at least a bear wakened from his den? So over the years, their relationship changed very much. So when they kind of were put in contact in the mid-1730s, Collinson saw himself very much above the kind of the humble American farmer. And he, for example, suggests to him that he should go down to Virginia, the oldest of the colonies. And this is what he writes to him. He says to Bartram, pray, go very clean, neat, and handsomely dressed to Virginia, and don't disgrace thyself or me. But over the years, they become really equals. And their correspondence is one of the nicest correspondence I've ever read in my many years as a historian, because you see, it's almost like a love developing between them through their passion for plants. And over time, Collinson introduces Bartram to all the important European scientists. Bartram's observations are read at the Royal Society, the most important scientific forum in Britain. But also, over those years, they become like a bickering old couple. And they have kind of petty little arguments, which can take years, because the letters take so long to kind of be sent. So Collinson will write something. It takes like 3 months for the letter to arrive at Bartram's house. Then Bartram will say, like, what, you can't say that, and kind of writes a letter back, because they take copies of the letter. So during those petty arguments, they refer back to letters someone had, you know, the other person had written 3 years ago. And it's just wonderful to see. So for example, there's one, the English gardeners, they become very, very greedy very quickly, and they want more and more and more. And so poor old Bartram is kind of zigzagging up and down the colonies. And Collinson writes that the English gardeners want more. And then Bartram writes back, for example, saying, I've sent seeds of almost every tree and shrub from Nova Scotia to Carolina. Do they think I can make new ones? So they kind of go on, and over 40 years, they change the English landscape completely. And at the same time, as they're doing that, there's a quiet revolution going on in the flower beds of England. And the man responsible for that is Philip Miller, who is the head gardener at the Chelsea Physic Garden. And this is the Chelsea Physic Garden as you would have approached it then from the river. And when Miller arrives there in the mid-1720s, he finds that most of the flower beds are pretty empty, because his predecessors have sold off all the exotic, kind of expensive flowers. But within a decade, he turns it into one of the most thriving botanical collections in Europe. And he does so by building up a network of contacts. So he is writing to botanists and gardeners across the world. They're swapping observations, they're swapping seeds, they're swapping plants. But what is really, really remarkable about Philip Miller is that he writes a book which changes everything. And that book is The Gardener's Dictionary, which he, the first edition, publishes in 1731, and he publishes six editions during his lifetime. Now, this doesn't seem very revolutionary to us or exciting, but it is the first comprehensive, practical guide to gardening. What it is it's a dictionary that lists every single plant that is in cultivation in England alphabetically. And each entry gives you information on how to propagate and cultivate a plant. Not very exciting to us, but at that time, it is the very, very first time that professional knowledge is available for the amateur gardener. Until then, most horticultural publications were still very much built on superstition and myth. So at the same time, in 1731, when he is publishing this dictionary, which is entirely built on scientific observations and on experiments, at that same time, you still have horticultural publications which, for example, advise you that if you want to have roses with double blossom, you should plant them during the full moon, or which advise that if you graft lemons on mulberry trees, they will turn red. So there's this book which suddenly gives the English gardener all the information they need, and it is the foundation of modern horticulture. It's really the mother of all plant encyclopedias, which we, you know, which we have standing on our bookshelves today. But Miller did not just work in the Chelsea Physic Garden. He also advised wealthy gardeners, together with Collinson, how to plant Bartram's seeds. And one of those was a man called Lord Petre, who had an estate called Thorndon in Essex. And Petre is one of those forgotten figures in history. He was hailed as the most innovative gardener of his time, and today no one really knows him. He was one of the first subscribers of Bartram's boxes, and he didn't just buy one box, he would buy dozens and dozens of boxes. So his garden in Thorndon had, in the late 1730s, 200,000 foreign plants. So this is a completely different garden to any other garden there had been. And what Miller, Collinson, and Petre did in this garden, with the help of Bartram's plants, was to dismantle the ideas that had underpinned the late 17th century and early 18th century garden. So they changed the formal garden into a more natural garden. And this is a depiction of how a very typical formal garden would have looked like in the early 18th century. So you see hedges kind of clipped into green walls. This is a garden that is ruled by geometry. There's, you know, no flower head is allowed to grow unruly in a garden like this. And this is a plan of Thorndon. I don't know if you can actually see that, but so it's a garden that is still slightly formal, so there's still, you know, straight lines, but you can also see all these kind of like wiggly, meandering paths. So this is a garden where nature is invited. This is a garden. What they do is they remove the corset that man has put on nature. And they do that with the help of Bartram's plants. So instead of bringing patterns into the garden with parterres or topiary, they use the different shapes that the American plants come in. So the American trees become the globes, the spheres, the columns that until then was done with the pruning shears. And they use, as Miller says, they use the leaves of the different trees, for example, as shades of light and dark. And they use these plants, as Collinson says, as living pencils. So they are drawing with these new plants, because for the first time, the English gardener has such a variety of plants at hand at this particular moment. Because until Bartram sends his plants, the autumn, for example, is a fairly lacklustrous affair in England, kind of, you know, muted browns and yellows. But suddenly, you have these kind of amazing autumn colors. You have the bright red of sugar maple set against the buttery yellow of tulip poplar. You have the red of scarlet oak against the aubergine of liquid amber. So there's color at all time of the year suddenly. So because Bartram introduces a lot of evergreens, like the white pine, because in England we only have four native evergreens, Scots pine, holly, box, and yew. So the English gardeners were going crazy for American evergreens and conifers. Bartram introduced witch hazel, color in the winter. No one had seen something like this before. He introduced magnolias. He introduced the first rhododendrons and hydrangeas from America. So the garden, which had looked until then good for about 5 months a year, looked good all year round. But all these new plants also brought a lot of confusion to the gardening world, because a new plant that arrived in England could have a different name in London to Liverpool to Paris to Leiden. And the gardeners got very upset about that, because they were paying huge amount of money for these kind of rarities. And then, so they would get a plant which had a name planted, and then they would kind of see another plant list with other names, and they ordered that for a lot of money. And then they realized they'd actually bought the same plant. And the man who set out to bring order to this confusion was the Swedish botanist Carl Linnaeus. Now, Carl Linnaeus was an obsessive classifier. He was very ambitious. He was arrogant. He called himself rather modestly the Prince of Botanists. But he was also a genius botanist. And he liked to show off. He invented dangers. For example, when he went on a plant hunting trip to Lapland, he just invented these kind of, accidents where he fell into a deep crevasse just to kind of make himself look like an intrepid adventurer. He lied to the Swedish Royal Society, who financed that trip, by just making up big detours. So he's kind of adding all these miles to his trip. But he's so fastidious that he bases that on previous travelers' accounts, so that the mileage kind of really properly is aligned to what they had said. And he liked to show off in this costume, which was a Lapland costume, in which he arrived to the Netherlands to impress the botanist, but he also courted his wife in this, so it obviously worked on her. And so he arrived in England in 1736 because he had come up with a new classification system, which is the so-called sexual system. And it's a classification system that is based on the reproduction organs of plants. And he came to England to convince the English gardeners and botanists to use this. And the very first person he goes to meet is Peter Collinson, just to give you an idea how important Collinson was at that time. And then he goes to Philip Miller. And this sexual system is a very, very simple thing. Basically, what he does is he divides the world of flowering plants into 23 classes based on the number of the male organs, the stamens. So everybody who could count could basically work with this system. And then he further divides these groups into more classes by counting the number of the female reproduction organs, the pistils. Now, this whole system was rather shocking for the English botanist, because he called the female organs the wives, and the male organs, the husbands. So the English were rather shocked by the indecency of the sexual system. And Collinson wrote to Bartram that it tends but to embarrass and perplex the study of botany. So the botanists were rather scandalized by this idea that plants were making love in the flower head, which was not helped by the fact that Linnaeus called the flower head the bridal bed. And I'm just going to read you a few quotes to give you an idea how shocking it must have been for the English. Because according to Linnaeus, one wife frolicked with six husbands in the lily's flower head. Tulip trees enjoyed 20 males or more in the same marriage. Marigold and ash trees, even more promiscuous because they had flowers which, with husbands which lived with wives and concubines. So suddenly the whole plant world seemed to be involved in this giant horticultural orgy. And unsurprisingly, Linnaeus failed to convince the English botanists. In fact, one botanist said that the sexual system was too smutty for British ears. He also tried to introduce his naming system, which he came up with in 1753, which to this day is still our international plant naming system. Again, a very simple way to do this. So until then, plant names, Latin plant names, had to include a description of the plant. So for example, today's Kalmia angustifolia was called this, which means evergreen dwarf laurel with oblong narrow leaves growing in bunches which are placed opposite. Now that's quite a mouthful for a plant name. Also, the plant names had to change every time they found a new species. You had to adjust the other plant names to either say, like, it's not growing like this, or, you know, it has, like, hairy leaves. So Linnaeus' solution, like the sexual system, was very straightforward and simple. He came up with a Latin with Latin plant names that were just based on two names, pretty much like a first name and a surname. So, for example, you have Magnolia, which is the surname, it's the name of the genus, and then you have Grandiflora, which is like the first name, the name of the species. So Magnolia, Grandiflora, Kalmia, the genus, Angustifolia, the species. Because of that, we can now buy a plant here in America or in Germany, and we know we're buying exactly the same plant, which is something I realized when I did the American edition for the Brother Gardeners, and I've used a few common names in there, and suddenly the whole thing went into chaos because so many common names in England are different in America. So I had to go back to the Latin names to make sure I'm using the right ones. And that's all down to Linnaeus. This naming system also gave him the power to confer immortality on his fellow botanists. So he could name beautiful plants for his friends. So for example, the Kalmia was named after his pupil Per Kalm. The Radbeckia was named after his teacher, Radbeck. But, of course, they're not just pretty plants around. They're also weeds. So he could use this in revenge. So his enemies got slightly different plants. So there was one man called Johann Georg Sigisbeck, for example, who was the botanist in the botanical garden in St. Petersburg. And Sigisbeck had criticized, quite viciously criticized, Linnaeus' sexual system. So he got the Zigbegesia, which is a weed that thrives in wastelands. So he was not very pleased about that. But again, Linnaeus had problems convincing the English to use the system. And then finally he decides that he was going to send his favorite pupil, Daniel Solander, to England to convince the English to use his system. So Solander arrived in London in 1760, and by then the English were really the leading gardening nation. And Solander couldn't believe what he was seeing. I mean, wherever he turned in London, there were gardens, there were residential gardens, there were parks, there were nurseries, there were market gardens, there were garden squares. So wherever he looked, there were gardens, because by then England was so much better in terms of horticulture, but also in terms of what kind of plants they had in their gardens. And a lot of these gardens were populated with Bartram's plants, and I'm just going to show you a few so that you can get an idea of what the English gardeners liked. So there was a Calicarpa, the American beauty berry, which the English absolutely adored for their for these kind of like purple berries which cling like bracelets around the branches. The tulip tree, again, for the kind of strangely shaped leaves, but also the beautiful blossom. Magnolia grandiflora caused pretty much a sensation when it first flowered in America, in England. Robinia hispida, again, a kind of flowering tree. So that's really what the English liked. And then the Indian bean tree. So even Capability Brown, the you know, the gardener who we think created the archetypal English garden, even he was using a lot of American trees, Bartram's trees, in his gardens. And by then, the English were just going crazy for gardens. And this is what Collinson, for example, writes to Bartram in 1763, that plants have become an infatuation in English. So great is the itch that a poor, ragged shoemaker, a weaver, or a baker will give half a guinea or a whole for a new flower. And Solander loved England, because in Sweden it was very different. So he charmed everybody here, and Collinson adored him and then plotted to keep him in England and gave him and kind of helped him to get a job at the new British Museum, where Solander was sorting and classifying, according to Linnaeus' system, the natural history objects there. Now, Linnaeus was getting rather upset because he had sent Daniel Solander just to, you know, advertise his system, but he didn't want to lose him entirely because he had trained him up to be his successor at the Botanic Garden in Uppsala. So he wrote to him again and again, and he also promised him that he could marry his daughter. So he's, you know, trying to seduce him to kind of come back. But he did not hear anything at all from Solander for 10 years. So the Solander was clearly a little bit conflict averse, I think. The first thing that Linnaeus hears from Solander is a letter written from the Endeavour in Rio de Janeiro, because Solander had left on the most daring voyage that the British organized in the 18th century. He accompanied Captain Cook and Joseph Banks on the circumnavigation on the Endeavour. The Joseph Banks had met Solander in the British Museum, where he'd spent a lot of time. And Joseph Banks was one of the wealthiest landowners at that time. And he was, like the other brother gardeners, absolutely in love with flowers and plants from a very, very early age. He had actually spent a lot of time in the Chelsea Physic Garden when he was younger, because his mother lived right next to it. And in August 1768, the Endeavour set sail in England. And 3 months later, they arrived in Rio de Janeiro. And Banks could not wait to get off the ship and to do some plant hunting, because he had spent £10,000 for his passage and his team's passage. So he, you know, he's very keen to get these flowers. But the Portuguese viceroy thought that they were spies, so they were not allowed to leave the boat. So there they were, standing on the Endeavour, looking through their telescopes to the shore, seeing this amazingly strange flora, these kind of trees laden with exotic fruits, bougainvilleas dripping with pink blossom. And this is how Banks felt at that moment. He writes this to a friend. He felt like a Frenchman laying swaddled in linen between two of his mistresses, both naked, using every possible means to excite desire. Linnaeus says something very similar. I mean, these men, it's a quite visceral passion they have. So Linnaeus says something very similar when he's waiting for his... when he's waiting for his pupil, Per Kalm, to come back from a plant collection exhibition. He wrote, "I long for him like a bride for 1 o'clock at night." So Banks and Solander sailed on to Tahiti, where they spent 3 months, and they enjoyed the island very much, which was not only down to the beautiful plants they found there, but also because they rather enjoyed the island's women. And then they continued, went to New Zealand, and then in almost 2 years after they had left England, they arrived at a place where no white man had ever been, the east coast of Australia. And they just couldn't believe what they were finding there. There were these huge eucalyptus trees, kind of with peeling bark. There was the striking evergreen Banksia, which received its name after Joseph Banks, and then Callistemon, the bottle brush. So they were seeing all these amazing plants, and they called the place of their first landfall Botany Bay, because they found so much there. When they returned to England in July 1771, their portfolios of pressed plants were absolutely full. So they brought back 30,000 specimens, 3,600 species, of which 1,400 were new to European botanists, which is a huge amount if you think that at that time only 6,000 species were known. And they were celebrated like heroes. And Banks, over the next decades, used his fame to turn London into the center of botany and scientific inquiry. He sent out plant hunters. He wrote to army officers, to merchants, and to missionaries to kind of send plants back to London. He became the president of the Royal Society. He became the nominal director of Kew Gardens, and he turned his private house in Soho Square into an academy of natural sciences. But at heart, he very much remained a hands-on botanist who, whenever he saw a lovely plant, he would just jump out of his carriage and kind of pluck it. And he was once arrested as a highwayman on a village common because he was found in a ditch kind of stuffing plants into his pockets. And he had a wife, and a quite long-suffering wife, I think. And he gave her, for example, a dried bit of moss to wear as a brooch. Now, he thought it was a rather spectacular, rare moss, and she thought it was rather unsightly. And when she refused to pin it to her blouse, Banks called her a fool that she likes diamonds better and cannot be persuaded to wear it, as a botanist's wife she certainly ought to do. So he was not collecting for beauty or for botanical completeness like Miller or like Collinson. He really believed that plants would bring economic profit to this country. So his idea was to turn Kew Gardens into a storehouse of the empire, into an engine of colonial growth. It would make Britain rich to get these plants. So what he's doing is he's sending out these plant hunters, and they get official instructions, which is to collect pretty flowers for the king, for the botanical collection in Kew. But they also got private instructions, where they were asked to steal potentially lucrative plants and crops. So this is, when you read these letters, there's proper horticultural espionage he's doing there. And one of those projects is to transport breadfruit trees from the East Indies, where Banks had seen them, to the West Indies, where he thought they would make very good food for the slave population on the sugar plantations. So it is Banks who sends in 1787 the Bounty under the command of Captain William Bligh to the East Indies. Now, we all know that that venture didn't quite work out. And after the infamous mutiny on the Bounty, the last thing that Captain Bligh saw of his 1,015 breadfruit trees was one view into his great cabin, and then he was cast on an open boat. Because the Bounty, this is a detail of the ship plan, and this is the great cabin. Every single circle you see here is a pot, a plant pot, for a breadfruit tree. This is the very first time that a ship is entirely equipped just for plant transportation. The great cabin is turned into a floating greenhouse. The captain has a very small cabin suddenly here, just this one. So he was relegated to there. The only cargo that the Bounty was carrying was the water they needed to water the breadfruit trees. Now, somehow Bligh manages to come back to England, and they kind of do the same thing again, and at that time it actually works. At the same time, so this is the end of the 18th century, at the same time you have thousands of plants flooding into England from the empire. Many of our favorite garden plants today arrive at that time. So you have fuchsias from South America, you have dahlias from Mexico, you have hostas from Japan, magnolias and hydrangeas from Asia. At the same time, Bartram's American plants are now so cheap, so the prices are plummeting. There are 200 nurseries in London alone. And at the beginning of the 18th century, you had 50 nurseries in the whole of Britain. So the English garden has become so fashionable that European gardeners are now copying the English garden. So you have in Germany the Englische garden. You have in France the Jardin l'Anglais. You have in Italy the Il Giardino l'Anglese. I can't get that out today properly. So everywhere you have the English garden in Europe. Catherine the Great is sending her gardener to England to learn about the English garden. And in 1776, in this very strange twist in history, I think, when the American colonies declare independence, the English garden is actually filled with the towering trees and shrubs from the former colonies. And it's an irony that John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, when they go on a garden tour in England in 1786, immediately realize that the English garden is actually not English at all, it's American. And they return to America and they create gardens, proud gardens, which are political statements in which they only use Native American species. But that is another book. So let me finish with a final look at the English garden. So by the end of the 18th century, the English are all completely crazy about their gardens. So crazy that plant thieves are emptying gardens again and again. Peter Collinson's gardens gets emptied 3 times, completely robbed of all his exotic plants. So he and his friends push through an act through Parliament where plant theft is punished with deportation, transportation to a penal colony. So it's become so important for the English. So the English garden becomes almost like a prerequisite for happiness or for Englishness itself. And I want to finish with one slide. Sorry. Now, this is a satire, obviously, and it's done in 1777, and I found a diary entry which seems to describe exactly this. So one onlooker at a dinner party describes this. 11 damsels which had, amongst them on their heads, an acre and a half of shrubbery, besides slopes, grass plats, tulip beds, clumps of peonies, kitchen gardens and greenhouses. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.